And after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. As long as our congregations were self-contained ethnic and religious groups, they could grow and perpetuate themselves simply by internal growth through infant baptism. And since more and more of our congregations are finding themselves within the mainstream of America, the question of how the church should grow has become more critical. Even if Jesus had not given a command for world evangelism, we would be compelled to do world missions simply from the very logic of the universal atonement and justification. A Christian does not have to be told to do mission work. The Bible is full of accounts of those who went and spoke about Jesus without having been given a command or a commission to do so. The question is not that Christ should be preached, but the question is, how should we speak of him to those who do not know of him? And at this point, our church might be on the edge of a crisis. A recent issue of one of our official church publications claims that church evangelism consists in telling others how happy we are to be Christians. To do this, this publication offers specific suggestions. Instead of saying what a beautiful day it is, we are now supposed to go around saying, what a beautiful day the Lord has made. The ultimate suggestion is for wedding announcements, which should no longer say and invite people to the happiest day in the couple's lives, but should now say to the second happiest day in the couple's lives, since their baptism was the happiest. Upon reading such useless, pious trivia, my first impious but completely sincere thought was that the couple perhaps had both been previously married and that the second marriage was not as happy as the first. I am not so sure that felicitations are the best method of evangelism. After hearing Dr. Bowles' exposition 2 days ago on Job's misery wrought by God and Satan, many of us professional Jobs would be automatically excluded from the evangelism missionary task. In recent years, many of us have been impressed by apologetics as an effective evangelism technique in order to present the reasonableness of Christianity to the world. Certain concrete historical facts from the Bible, especially the resurrection of Jesus, are used in apologetics to break down the scientific barriers that prevent unbelievers from recognizing Christian truth. The method is appealing, at least to us, because it places the foundation of Christian truth outside of our hearts and squarely in the mainstream of history where revelation did take place. Objectivity replaces subjectivity, and that's always good. Christians are put on an equal footing with the academic community and other groups which consider themselves intellectually respectable. The biblical evidence is weighed according to scientifically acceptable methods, and the results should be certain and incontrovertible. Conclusions which can be accepted by all believers and unbelievers. Now, in doing apologetics, I'm not so sure that we are not convincing ourselves more than we are convincing our hearers. As an almost totally convinced believer in the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin as actually being the burial cloth of Jesus, and my faith is built on purely statistical data and scientific proof, I appreciate a certain objective undergirding for Christian faith. And from time to time, the church has felt compelled to preach its message to the academic or the scientific community on the terms of the community. Origen is supposed to have walked around in a philosopher's gown. And the Protestants to this very day wear their academic apparel in the pulpit, so that they can be identified with the teachers of the world. The most significant approach proudly taken to the intellectual world in the apostolic period was probably Paul's Athenian speech on the Areopagus to the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Today, we would probably call what he did apologetics, since he tried to convince his hearers on their own terms about the reasonableness of Christianity. There were good reasons to become Christian. Paul's outline and his message is clear and it's simple. It goes like this. His hearers were religious people, and they did not have to be convinced about the existence of the divine, since they indeed worshiped many gods. One God, however, at least in Paul's presentation, was different from their gods, since this God had not been created. Instead, he was the creator of all things. He could not be fashioned into gold or silver, but instead, he created all men and he lived within them. Now this God was patient in giving men all over the world an opportunity to find him. However, this would not last forever, since on one day, he would hold all men morally accountable to himself. Now the proof concerning this God and concerning his judgment was that he has already chosen one man to be the judge. And the proof of this was this man's resurrection from the dead. Paul's argument, and that's what it was, more of an argument than it was a sermon, for Christianity, was logical and resembles what we call in dogmatics the ethnic argument for God's existence. Christianity, on a rational basis, is clearly the superior religion, since its God was the active creator, and their gods were passive created things. And the clinching argument for the truth was that God had raised one man from the dead. Well, you know what happened. Instead of a grand endorsement of the truth from the academicians, instead, there came a chorus of howls, laughter, and cackles, with, of course, an invitation to come back and give another lecture. There is no record that Paul ever accepted this invitation. But if he did, there is every reason to believe that he would have changed his format and gone back to his usual straightforward style of condemnation and proclamation, what we Lutherans call by the cliché, the law and the gospel. Now, in all of us preachers, there is a little of that spirit of St. Paul who secretly enjoys being dragged to Mars Hill by the academic mob to demonstrate our ability at intellectual persuasion. Certainly, we could not, with a clear conscience, refuse an invitation to make a clear and articulate confession of our Christianity within the university or the academic forum. Few things are more personally gratifying than meeting and defeating the world on its own terms. For my part, I would go about it like this. I would suggest proving the existence of God as a necessary component of any meaningful ethical system so necessary for social living. And then to demonstrate the existence of Jesus and his resurrection, you know what I would do. There is always the shroud. But if we did this, and we did it convincingly, I am not so sure that we would really be like the real, authentic St. Paul. There was that other real, authentic St. Paul who quickly left intellectual Athens, leaving behind such meager results that the name of his converts could be mentioned by Luke, that the real St. Paul left Athens and went to morally corrupt Corinth. There in Corinth, among the offscouring of the world, the temple priestesses and the prostitutes, the self-indulgent and the intoxicated, the adulterous and the incestuous, the cantankerous and the belligerent, the schismatic and the heretical. It was there that Paul developed his gospel message to perfection. A woman afflicted by her sin cries for mercy to Jesus, but the Greek intellectuals laugh at Paul's message. Philosophers can appreciate the arguments for God's existence, but sinners are laid open, seared, frightened, scared, and destroyed when God forces them to look at themselves as they really are. Unless we are weighed down by the enormity of our sin and its guilt, then all the philosophical, religious, and historical arguments for the truthfulness of Christianity are useless. Even Jesus said this, that the appearance of a dead man among the living could bring nobody to faith. And I think he was right. Only a man first destroyed by the law is able to appreciate what God has done for all men in the cross. There is something unusual about the speech on the Areopagus. The patterns of St. Peter's and St. Paul's speech, as they have been editorialized for us by St. Luke in the book of Acts, follow a certain recognizable pattern of condemnation of sin, then followed by a reference to God's work in letting Jesus be crucified for our sins, his endorsement by God by being raised from the dead, and his direct declaration by God the Father that this Jesus was indeed Lord or Christ. For what reason, then, did Luke preserve a speech which was so unlike anything else ever preached or at least recorded from the apostolic period? Was it a warning to us that faith can rarely be received or obtained through rational arguments? A definitely disappointed and perhaps internally chastised Paul went from the academic marketplace where ideas are bartered and sold. He went from the academic marketplace to that den of iniquity. And in spite of the downright cheapness and stinginess of the Corinthians, his message was heard and believed, and it did make a difference in their lives. No letter to the Athenians has been preserved. Probably there wasn't any because there were not enough people to write it to. But two letters to the Corinthians have been preserved, and there were several more. Do you think that there is any possibility that in writing his first letter to the church at Corinth, St. Paul was thinking of his personal defeat at the Areopagus when he said, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever. I will thwart. And where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe." None of us will ever be immune to the Athenian sirens. And we will answer their call to go to the Areopagus even when they do not beckon us. But like St. Paul, we will have that constant reawakening that the message of salvation comes in human words, but that its message is beyond and above all human philosophies. It is this message of divine wisdom that gives to the most ignorant the highest secrets of heaven. And after this, he left Athens and went to Corinth.